Wisconsin State Supreme Court is now in session. The Honorable Chief Justice Annette Kingsland Ziegler presiding. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Good morning. I understand we have court with class groups here for oral argument this morning. Platteville High School, if you could stand, please.
Good.
Nice to see you. Good group. Good to have you here today. Go ahead and have a seat. Homeschooled Middleton students, nice to see you here today, too. Welcome. And then I was alerted that there are other classes here, but not signed up, so you're catching me by surprise. I'm going to need you to introduce yourself to me and then stand up. So pick a representative to introduce any other school. Why don't you stand up? Wonderful. It's great to see you. I'm glad you're here, and you're welcome anytime. It's just that you're not on my sheet, and I want to acknowledge you. All right. Go ahead and have a seat. Any other students here today that want to say hello? All right. Perfect. Thanks. It's nice to have you all here today. And Justice Protasevich is able to meet with you over the noon hour if you're able to come back. You can ask her any questions you think might be interesting, and she can try to answer them. Sometimes those are the toughest questions of all, actually. So welcome, and it's nice to have you. Our first case this morning is McDaniel versus Wisconsin Department of Corrections. It's 22 AP 1759 CR. Could I start with your appearances? Good morning. Good morning. All right, the lineup I have is 25 minutes, followed by 30 minutes, 5 minutes on rebuttal, right? Okay. All right, with that, please proceed.
Chief Justices, and may it please the court. The petitioners and the proposed class all have suffered the same injury in this case. They have not been paid for their pre- and post-shift work. The case of the petitioners and the proposed class all rested on the same contention, that their pre- and post-shift work was integral and indispensable to their shift work and thus compensable under Wisconsin law. Determining, and I'm not asking this court to do it, but determining the truth or falsity of that contention would have decided a central issue to all of the cases in one stroke. Because of this commonality, and because after reviewing all other class factors and the facts pertaining to them, the requirements of 803.08 had been met, the circuit court properly exercised its discretion and certified the class. The Court of Appeals committed two errors. It answered this common question, the central contention, on the merits, even though that's exactly what you're not supposed to do at class certification stage in this type of case. Second, the Court of Appeals answered the question wrongly. Now, We believe this court should only reach the first error, because to go further would upend settled law on class action certification and the proper scope of review of courts in class action certification. So, the Department of Corrections' main argument in the Court of Appeals and the argument that the Court of Appeals approved and adopted was the circuit court improperly certified a class based on a mere pleading standard because the circuit court thought it was sufficient that the core legal theory was sufficiently plausible. Respondents, the state, the Department of Corrections, argument was exactly the same argument that the losing side made in the Amgen versus Connecticut retirement plan case. In that case, this is what the court says in the majority opinion. Amgen contend that to meet the predominance requirement, Connecticut retirement must do more than plausibly plead that Amgen's alleged misrepresentation and misleading omissions materially affected Amgen's stock price. And here's what the U.S. Supreme Court said in response to that. While Connecticut retirement must prove materiality prevail on the merits, we hold that such proof is not a prerequisite to class certification. Rule 23, the federal counterpart to 803.08, requires a showing that questions common to the class predominate, not that those questions will be answered on the merits in favor of the class. Now, the Court of Appeals and the Department of the Corrections primarily rely on the Dukes case, Walmart versus Dukes in the U.S. Supreme Court, for the proposition that you have to do more, that you can go into the merits in a way that the Department of Corrections and the Court of Appeals suggest. But Dukes doesn't save this ruling. Dukes went into the merits because there was complete overlap on a central tenet of the class's claim, a pattern and practice of discrimination, and the commonality issue, the glue that held the class together, whether there was a pattern and practice. And Justice Scalia correctly said when there's a disputed pattern and practice, a dispute as to the glue that holds the class together, of course you have to test that under the preponderance of the evidence standard. And there are many of those cases. There are many pattern and practice cases where that's disputed before federal courts and state courts. This isn't one of them. The Department of Corrections have admitted that there is a policy of non-payment of pre-shift and post-shift time of correction officers in this case. They have admitted the policy. The common question isn't the glue that holds the class together. The common question is a step removed from that glue. It needs to be answered for our clients to prevail, but it isn't a disputed pattern and practice case. So the common contention is the integral and indispensable issue. And
counsel, it seems to me that you have perhaps artfully, perhaps carefully, indicated the commonality in part is based on, what do you have here? From the time they enter the doors to the time they exit the doors. That's the way you've framed it. If I read your briefing correctly, particularly I thought it was set forth on page 13 of your reply brief. But am I getting that correct? That's the framework with which you are proceeding, from the time they enter the door to the time they exit. That's the commonality.
We are proceeding from that framework, Justice mm-hmm. Bradley. That's one of the common glues that holds this case together, the other being the admitted policy of the state of of that time. Mm-hmm. But I would agree with you, and that is our contention, that from the time they enter the buildings and enter the security envelope until the time they exit, that time is compensable.
Now, within that time, you have several items, picking up keys, the screening. And arguably, that may, if you just focused on some of the discrete actions, that is, when they're leaving their duty, they have to give information to the person taking over their duty, et cetera. Those kinds of things that you have set forth. If you focused on those rather than this broader time frame, you might have some problems with commonality.
It would. I do not think commonality is destroyed. It would be smaller commonality. There are maybe fewer members in a particular class if a court on the merits were to hold at some point that the door-to-door doesn't work and focused on the donning and doffing of security mm-hmm. equipment. It doesn't destroy commonality, but it may make the class smaller in this case. And on the common issue here, because it is a common issue whether you focus on entry to exit or if you focus on donning and doffing equipment, it's still that same question. Is it integral and indispensable to the work? And I will remind this court, although I suspect, knowing many of you, that you don't need a reminder, that in the United Food and Commercial Worker versus Hormel case, where y'all took on the donning and doffing issue, you did that on a full trial record after Judge Fitzpatrick had conducted a trial in the circuit court. You're likely to hear a lot today. I may say a few words about it, and the Department of Corrections may say a few words about the Bua Fakeo case. I think that's the correct pronunciation. We listened to the U.S. Supreme Court arguments. Bua Fakeo case.
For those sticklers in pronunciation who happen to sit.
But in Bua Fakeo, the Supreme Court had before it, the jury had determined the issue of integral and indispensable.
And so, Attorney Burns, if you're like me, I like to get to work a little bit early, and maybe on the way out I want to chat with somebody for 15 minutes. To me, that would cause a problem with the time that you enter the building, the time you exit the building, commonality issue. How do you work around that?
Just as Prentice said, you work at a much more pleasant place. I don't think it generally, as a matter of what it, at least my common sense, I've handled, I know that many of you have been prosecutors, you have been circuit judges, you have gone to prisons. These aren't places where you hang out. I remember when I was a lawyer in Chicago and I had a capital murder case and I had to schlep down to 26 and Cal every week. That place is dangerous. There are people walking around who can snap my neck.
So you think they want to be in and out, correct?
I think they want to be in and out pretty quickly, but I mean, they come in, the evidence is, would support that. They don't, come individually, one guy an hour before, one guy 45 minutes, let's hang out, watch TV, let's, talk to the prisoners for a while. They end up coming in, in clumps, according to the evidence. And so I think that, and remember, our task on the merits, well, not because we can't, because the Department of Corrections here didn't keep time records like it's required to do. We can't, go to the clock and say, I was chatting with so-and-so for 3 minutes. Under prevailing U.S. Supreme Court law in a wage claim, we have the ability to use representative evidence. And the best representative evidence we can come up with is looking when people enter, looking when people leave. It's, of course, subject to cross-examination on the merits, and that very issue will no doubt be raised by our able opponents on the merits of this case, and it may not get somewhere before the judge or the jury, but we are not at the merits stage here.
Counsel, yeah, I feel kind of like some of the questions are moving into what this claim will survive versus whether class can be certified. And to me, those are distinct issues. Back in my trial judge days, the Wisconsin rule was not the same as the federal rule. Mm-hmm. Then, about 2017 or so, this court adopted a proposal to change the Wisconsin rule and have it conform, basically, with federal practice. So, sometimes it helps me to think of practical realities of how this would work. Is it your request that we conclude that when determining class certification, you do not get to merits, and when determining class certification to get to merits at that stage would sort of flip-flop appellate review in a way where interlocutory appeal and appeal as of right would make no sense, really? I'd like you to discuss that a little bit, because to me, that seems to be one of your more persuasive arguments, the reality of how the appellate process would work if merits are discussed at the certification stage versus if merits are discussed after it goes back down and everybody can duke out summary judgment or motion to dismiss, given the standards that apply at the trial court level.
Chief Justice, it's a very good point, and I'm not sure I can say it much better than you. I will amplify what you're saying. And the first two things I want to bring the court's attention to is on that issue is there's an amicus brief in this case that did a wonderful job of discussing the policy arguments, including that concern. And there's the...
Well, policy was decided when the rule was changed to conform basically to the federal rule. But I don't see appellate process as really a policy argument. I see it as more of a practical reality of when and how you segregate issues to be decided so that they all have their proper burden of proof and potential remedy depending on how the appellate process would work in that stage.
Totally agree. So if the Department of Corrections had lost on a motion to dismiss here, essentially a merits motion at the pleading stage, they would have no right to interlocutory review. If they had lost on a summary judgment, and we know the standard of review, like you said, a rigorous standard there, they would have had no immediate right to review in most circumstances if they had prevailed.
It almost turns the burden of proof on its head, right, as to what would happen in a trial court regarding summary judgment or motion to dismiss versus what happens if class certification issues are decided on the merits. It flips that.
Absolutely. And it brings a lot more merits questions before appellate courts on less than full records and without the burden of proofs we expect on summary judgment. Incidentally, Chief Justice, we haven't, although we've obviously engaged in some merits discovery as part of class discovery, there's some overlap there. Like in most cases, class cases, the scheduling order in the case bifurcates class certification discovery from merits discovery. If this court were to rule in our favor and send us back to the circuit court, one of the first things we would be doing is engaging in merits discovery on it. Numerous issues, including further merits discovery.
That kind of reminds me of bifurcating liability and coverage, right? Sometimes that works, but sometimes they're so intermingled that discovery ends up dealing with both of them and you deal with them kind of separately, but still discovery is conducted at the same time. So it would be the practical realities of that case as to whether discovery is specific to class certification or might in both veins, but that again would be before the trial court, right?
Before the trial court, Chief Justice. And I would agree, probably the better practice, if this were a disputed pattern in practice case like Duke's, the better practice would be to do merits discovery with class cert discovery, because the issue of the glue holding things together is so related to the merits. But that isn't this case.
What's the scope? Are you finished answering that question?
I am, Justice Bradley. Hopefully to the Chief Justice's satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. What was the scope of the certification by the Circuit Court here? And let me, as you're looking for it, and was that based in large part on your expert witness, William Rogers? I know the Court of Appeals opinion discusses that briefly in paragraph 4. But so what's the scope, and is it based in part on your expert's testimony?
So the scope is, and hopefully this is the question you're asking, all current former non-exempt hourly paid employees who worked as security personnel in correctional institutions, including but not limited to correctional officers and correctional sergeants in the state of Wisconsin in the proceeding.
Did the scope incorporate your apparent argument that it is from entering until exiting?
I think it's hard to say to be honest. I would say there are many things in the circuit court transcript and the circuit court opinion that suggest that the circuit court, and it may be outright, and I'm just forgetting, but that suggests that the circuit court at the class cert stage did buy into the argument, this what I call the vigilance argument, because it's a prison from the time you enter the security envelope until the time you leave. That should be compensable work. It's integral and indispensable.
Well, but isn't the vigilance argument kind of fallen by the wayside in some cases?
Justice Bradley, if you look at the cases where vigilance that the Department of Corrections cites, the main one they cite is the Shigoya case in the Seventh Circuit. First thing to know about Shigoya is that it was a summary judgment case. It was after evidence had been presented. It wasn't at class certifications stage like this case. So it's different there. But Shigoya was SWAT teams taking their cars and weapons home and having the option to respond. You know, they would be called, can you respond to this emergency? It wasn't leaving your home, going to a prison, sometimes high security prison, sometimes less security prison, and having to be there on this constant state of vigilance. But I truly think that is a question. It depends on the job function, and SWAT team functions are different from correctional officers' functions. It depends on the function. I would not mislead the court by saying that every court has seen it as something that goes to trial. Well, obviously, the integrity staffing case was decided on a motion to dismiss, but under Hormel, under this court decision that focuses on the particular job duty and whether it's integral and indispensable to the particular work that the person does, I don't know how you escape that it's a fact question. Now, some things can be so far removed, even if they're fact questions, that we don't want to waste anybody time, but I know many of you, like I have been to prisons. I don't think this is the case anywhere like the integrity staffing and the Amazon warehouse and exit screenings case. I deeply apologize. I see that my time is up. Justice Bradley, if I've sufficiently answered your question, I'd be prepared to sit down if the Chief Justice is okay.
We will hear from you on rebuttal. Thank
okay.
you.
Thank you.
All right.
Madam Chief Justice, and may it please the court. This is a wage claim case brought by a Department of Correction guards seeking to certify a class of approximately 5,000 former and current guards who work at 37 different institutions, each with different security levels and protocols, resulting in hundreds of different posts at various locations within those institutions, and in which the plaintiffs plead a laundry list of activities for which they claim unpaid compensation. Court of Appeals was correct in stating that this is not a proper class action case. Despite all these individualized differences, plaintiffs contend that they should represent this class based on a theory that before their paid shift begins, they all place their personal belongings, if they bring any in, to the prison on a conveyor belt through an X-ray machine. at each institution's entrance.
So Judge Easterbrook said something like, a certified class, whether it goes down in flames on the merits, is not an issue at class certification. I mean, you may be right. You may win all day long. I don't know the answer to that. But I hear you talking about merits at class certification. How is that the right place to decide class certification? I mean, class certification is one thing, right? And then it goes back for you to argue all the things that you seem to be arguing right now. I think that's how it typically works in the under the federal and now Wisconsin's law. So tell me how that works as a practical matter. Who has the burden to prove the class should not be certified? And how does that work?
Well, the plaintiffs have the burden to prove that the class should be certified.
Okay,
and we believe,
so in that process, do they have to prove that they're going to win their claim?
No, they do not. But what they are doing here, and this is a, maybe it's a unique case, maybe not, but in this case, the plaintiff's theory for commonality, that glue that is sticking all the individualized differences together, are these theories of a wage claim case. The theory based on an activity of going through a security screening or walking among the prison. And that is, those are not only merits-based questions, because they've pled those activities as uncompensated activities, but it also goes to the commonality and predominancy requirement and prerequisite in a class action case. So this is one of those times where courts can take a peek at the merits, they can touch the merits, and that is because plaintiffs have chosen to use the glue, to use these theories of liability as the glue to keep all these individuals together. And the Seventh Circuit cases, particularly the Danzel case that we cited, says that you can present a question that is common, but it's only common if the question, if they are right. So if the answer is no, then commonality falls apart and individualized questions predominate over the common ones.
How do you know that the answer is no until you have a trial or summary judgment? I mean, I'm looking at deposition transcripts, examination of Matthew Davis on page 99 of the deposition, where he's specifically asked about pre-shift activity and whether he would be likely to respond, because this is this idea that you're highly vigilant, and he's asked, and he says, absolutely. And then he said, and then the next question is, because there can be an emergency called at any time during pre-shift activity, do you have to remain alert and vigilant? Answer, yes, always. What more does a plaintiff class need to assert other than that, and knowing that you can, at summary judgment phase or at trial, prove that to be incorrect? But what other burden would they have other than to assert this with the members of the class?
Well, the former security director for the Department of Corrections also testified in depositions. Again, a lot of discovery took place.
Sure, and that sounds to me like a question of fact at that point.
And there's nothing wrong. The federal case law says there's nothing wrong with courts deciding disputes of fact or questions of fact for class certification, but I don't even think there is a dispute here, because Mr. Foster testified that there is an expectation that if there is a security call from entrance to post, guards are not expected to respond unless they are told to.
How come both of those things can't be true? And how is a judge supposed to know that at that stage? How come the expectation can be exact? How come it can't be that the expectation is exactly what he said, but that the reality is different? Isn't that why we have trials and discovery and all of that? And so you are putting a judge in the place of having to weigh credibility, having to, I mean, what is a judge supposed to do with those two facts at that stage? And you're saying not certify, and that just sounds totally crazy.
Well, I'm not sure if there is a dispute among those pieces of testimony, because the Department of Corrections also testified that if guards are called during their walk to the post, they will be compensated. And so that also raises an issue of it also raises an issue of individualized differences. And a class certification is, right?
Everybody has to be exactly the same. Is that really what you're, I mean, that does seem to be what you're saying, that there can't be any differences, that someone can't have a 15-minute walk to their post and versus a 30-minute walk? I mean, what kind of standard will we have for class certification if we accept the argument that you're making to us here today?
Well, the standard for class certification is that everybody has to have commonality, and for the predominancy aspect, the requirement of the class action certification has to show that individual questions will not predominate over common ones. And what I hear you saying, Justice Dowd, is that yes, there are many differences among the guards. They get their keys at different points along the way. They talk to someone at different points along the way. And those are all different types of activities.
I don't think that's what Mr. Burns' argument was. I mean, what I heard him say is this has to do with vigilance, right? And everything that Justice Dowd was talking about has to do with vigilance. And I think everything that you said in response, right? I mean, you have to be vigilant to know if you are walking in and getting the emergency call, you have to be vigilant enough to be able to respond, right? And so I think that is what the response is to what you're saying.
There are
different things, but they fall under this a common umbrella.
Right, and that's what is going on here. For the purpose of these plaintiffs bringing this case as a class action, they are trying to find the glue, the common glue that keeps them all together.
But in any class action, you're going to have very different people with very different damages or very different circumstances, very different lifespans, very different. You don't need commonality like that.
Well, for the purpose, so think of the Hormel case. That was a donning and doffing case, and I do want to say that this is not a donning and doffing case, no matter what the other side wants to characterize it as. The donning and doffing cases pertain to activities that all of the plaintiffs do in a contained and specific manner.
Just because you can find a case that does have that doesn't mean a class is precluded because it doesn't. If you're done with Justice Karofsky's question, talk to me a little bit about burdens of proof. Because if they have the burden to prove the class should be certified, and the answer to that burden of proof is their claim is insufficient, it needs to be dismissed. You've got two separate things going on, one of which would typically happen before a trial court, where the standard would be you'd have to prove that. But you're in a stage where they have to prove class certification, and it's being met with essentially a motion to dismiss. It's turning those burdens on their head. And it also upsets the normal process of appellate review as a matter of right versus interlocutory appeal.
Well, what the plaintiffs are saying is that the Court of Appeals issued a merits decision, and the Department's position is that it did not issue a merits decision. And the Court of Appeals likely knew that if they were reading the Dantzel case again, the Seventh Circuit case. The last paragraph at that case takes pains to say, we addressed a common question for the purposes of predominancy in that Dantzel case. We are not issuing a merits decision. It is only being addressed for the purposes of determining class certification. So when that case goes back down and individual plaintiffs want to prove a wage claim, they can use, in this case, a multitude of their activities. They're not prevented from using any of those. They're not prevented from going forward at all. The Court of Appeals didn't say they can't go forward. It's our position that it is not a merits-based merits decision. Again, this is one of those cases where they had to touch upon the merits to rule on class certification.
It does look like a likelihood of success on the merits determination.
Well, again, the federal case law says that when you do touch upon the merits and take a peek at the merits, you can look at the substantive claim, the elements of a substantive claim, and you can look at whether it has cohesiveness and a legal foundation. So it's the department's position that, yes, at the class certification stage, for the purposes of determining the class certification prerequisite and requirements, you can look and you must look at those legal theories. Because if you do not, if the court does not, as the Dantzel court says, then it is just a mere pleading standard, and that is not what Rule 23 and the state law class certification statute requires. It requires a rigorous analysis, not a mere pleading standard. And that's what happened here, is the circuit court, many times throughout its decision, used the phrase and the word plausibility. And unfortunately, that is a pleading standard. And so Rule 23 case law says that the courts do a rigorous analysis. And that means looking at the facts, not the allegations of the pleadings. And you look at common questions and seeing whether that common question, the theory behind it, has a legal foundation.
Counsel, here there was an expert that opined on that viewed, according to the Court of Appeals opinion and information and briefs, that viewed all of the comings and goings and testified to a commonality. Is that correct?
Yes. That's their theory.
That the expert testified to it is their theory?
The expert's testimony goes hand in hand with the theory that the plaintiffs are putting forward as to why there is a class here.
Recently in what state was it? Let me look. Maybe North Carolina had the same expert testify. And let me just find that. The North Carolina court, I think, granted class certification. That was Hodge versus North Carolina. So, 2024 decision. So that court, based on the same expert as presented here, found the commonality with the expert reviewing the comings and goings and the different the different activities, but put them together and found a sufficient commonality. And I think the circuit court here then based in part its decision, of course, on that expert's testimony. Is that correct?
That is correct. And what we've done here is we've briefed this issue. This is another reason why the department argued that class certification should not be granted. And this could be another reason on which to affirm the Court of Appeals decision. If justices, you are troubled by or don't agree with the reasoning of the Court of Appeals decision, there are other arguments, other reasons why the class should not be certified. And the evidence is one reason. We argued that the evidence goes to the predominancy requirement in a class action certification.
Are you familiar with that Hodge versus North Carolina decision?
Yes.
And can you distinguish it?
Well, the distinguishing aspect is that we disagree with it. We disagree with it.
No, that does not seem to be distinguishing from your position in this case.
Well, here, let me distinguish it with facts. So here the plaintiff's expert decided to clock the arrival time of each individual officer over a course of a day or so at three different prisons, and believed that there was some correlation between the time before the shift starts, the guards arrive, with the walk to the post. And our position is, the department's position is that is flawed evidence. One reason is because it is not representative of the individual's time for a wage claim. So we've got testimony from Ms. McDaniel says, it takes me sometimes up to 30 minutes to get from the front door to my post. On the other hand, Mr. Davis, another plaintiff, says it takes him maybe 1 minute to get there. So you can see that there are individualized differences between the time.
Individualized differences always would occur in a class because you have individual people with individual damages and individual claims and individual lifespans and all sorts of things.
Right, but the evidence that the plaintiffs are putting forward is they're trying to aggregate and average a time and apply a time frame, a number of minutes, to each and every class member.
And you might win. You might be absolutely right at a motion to dismiss or summary judgment, and it may be that their claim is fatally flawed. But at the class certification stage, you're saying they have zero commonality? There's nothing that brings them together to meet the test?
No. What we're saying with regard to the evidence is it's a predominancy failure.
I understand that, but okay. Give me all the things then. Tell me the things that they have in common.
That they have in common?
They're past or former DOC employees. They work
right.
At a particular clock in, they clock out. They have the exact same claim they're bringing for different damages depending on the person.
Right. And what the problem is with regard to class certification action is that the representative evidence that the plaintiffs need to show at a class certification stage is not representative of the time individuals take to get from the front door to their post.
That would just be individualized to whether, I mean, if they prevail on the claim, then it's individual as to whether they get those damages, right? Maybe there's a determination walking up to the door doesn't count. I don't know what happens in this case, but then the 30 minutes doesn't count for anybody, whether it's 30 or 5 or 10. I don't know what happens in the case. But right now, we're just deciding this group of people who have this common experience of working at DOC, and they clock in, and they have to get there early. Can they state a wage claim for that? That's the issue.
Well,
they may not be able to. They may lose all day long. I don't know the answer. But they do have a lot in common in that regard. Yet you would require each of them to bring a separate claim in a court of law. That's also a practical, that's not a reality on how that could ever work.
Well, again, I'll just stress that the evidence aspect is flawed because it is not representative. The Buafakeo court stated that a court can deny class certification on an expert analysis if no reasonable juror could have believed that the employees spent roughly equal time engaging in the activity for which they seek compensation. So the facts show that the two plaintiffs who are trying to get class certification have not unequal time.
So in every class certification, the test now would be, do you have equal time that you've spent?
Well, that's what was going on in Hormel, right? That was a Donnie.
Right, but that's based on those facts, looking for whether there's commonality or not. So the facts, it depends on the facts as to whether a class will be certified to a certain degree.
Right.
But the parsing out of whether the claim survived belongs at the trial court level.
But for the purposes of all of these different prerequisites and requirements in a class action certification, the courts are supposed to perform a rigorous analysis, which means looking past the pleadings and looking to the facts. And the facts here show these differences among...
Okay. So break this group of people into five different classes that you would be satisfied with, or three, or two. Do you have former employees and they could all fit in one class?
Here there are just so many different types of activities in which the plaintiffs are seeking wage claims. There would have to be a multitude of different classes, but the point is this, that it still wouldn't work, because where they pick up their keys, where among this, within each prison, it's different, where you pick up your key, where you may talk to someone else, there's so many differences that this is not the type of case for class action certification. So predominancy is a problem with regard to the evidence. The other problem with the evidence is it's flawed.
Before you get into flawed evidence, which arguably is not a consideration for the court, but maybe it is, I want to ask you some questions about the predominancy argument,
yes,
that you're making, because to segue from the Chief Justice's questions for you, tell us more about what happens if, let's say, this class is certified. You get an adverse ruling from this court. It goes back to the trial court. Is your argument then that the efficiency considerations under the statute are, that's the biggest problem under predominancy, because with a class action, there aren't individual determinations of damages for each individual, correct? It's everybody gets X, Y, or Z in damages, and that goes to efficiency because of class action. In a class, if the class is certified, it's because there's too many people. How many people are employees are we dealing with in this?
Around 5,000.
Okay, so the trial court judge isn't actually going to make an individualized determination of damages. If it's a court trial, the jury doesn't make that individualized determination of damages for each employee. Is that part of your argument?
That goes to our manageability argument, and that a reason for why this class should not have been certified. So if you read the Hermanson In re Walmart litigation case from the Court of Appeals, it talks about a defendant having a constitutional right to challenge at trial the accuracy of evidence at which the plaintiff in a class action is putting forward. Here what we've said is Dr. Rogers says, I'm going to allot 10 minutes to each and every individual, even though we know that there's differences. We're going to allot 10 minutes of time for each person's wage claim. So everybody's going to get 10 minutes, and they're going to be multiplied by their hourly rate. Department isn't saying you can't have a class action because there's going to be different amounts. What we're saying is that under the In re Walmart litigation, the department would have the ability to cross-examine, I believe plaintiff's counsel even said this, cross-examine the expert of the plaintiffs to challenge his decision and his methodology of allotting 10 minutes to each person. So Ms. McDaniel would get less because she's saying she walked for 30 minutes. Mr. Davis would be getting a windfall because he's only walking 1 minute.
So is it your argument then that the class isn't efficient, that these individualized questions of fact actually predominate over the arguably common question of law that's being presented in the certification, because you're going to have 5,000 mini trials within one?
That is exactly our point, Your Honor.
In a class action, you're saying everyone has to receive the same damages in order for
No.
a class to be certified?
No, we recognize that each individual class, each putative class member could get a different amount of damages because it's going to be based on their hourly wage and the amount of time that they worked.
That's normal
Right.
for people
Right.
to receive different damages. And that's not an inefficiency argument
Right.
to be made, right?
And that's not what we were arguing, and that's, I think, what the circuit court misunderstood. That's not our argument. Our argument is with regard to, one, is the manageability aspect. That In re Walmart litigation case does say that you can challenge, the defendant can challenge the determination of the expert's methodology and evidence. And if we already have testimony from the plaintiffs, one plaintiff says it took me 30 minutes to get to post. Another says it took me 1 minute to get to post. When there is a trial, if there is a trial, on the merits of their wage claim, the department has the ability to cross-examine that expert and say, you're allotting 10 minutes to Ms. McDaniel and, you know, hundreds of other putative class members. What about her testimony that says, no, it was 30? Mr. Davis is getting 10 minutes allotted to him. He's testifying that it's 1 or 2 minutes.
But isn't that at the merit stage?
That is at the merit stage, and that's what that's where manageability comes in. So manageability is a kind of a sub-factor of predominancy in the state statute. And so if a class is unmanageable, the trial would be unmanageable, then that is a reason for a circuit court to deny class certification.
So counsel?
Please, go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry. So suppose it might be, but we did have a finding the other way. So, and we have a standard of review that calls this a discretionary decision. And so perhaps you have a little bit different kind of lift than if you were defending, you know, if you were in the opposite position here. So maybe the question at this point isn't, could a trial court have found the other way on that question, but did the trial court erroneously exercise its discretion in certifying the class? How would you address the standard of review and what we're supposed to do with that?
Well, for a erroneous exercise of discretion standard, any time there is an error of law, it is an erroneous exercise of discretion. So the department's position is, with regard to the manageability requirement of the class action statute, that the circuit court erred after reviewing the In Re Walmart litigation case and deciding, oh no, there's not going to be a problem with manageability here, recognizing that there has to be, there's a constitutional right for the department to cross-examine the expert with and his evidence. And so what that means is that each and every putative class member could be cross-examined as well, because what is going on here in Walmart litigation, there were questionnaires that the workers filled out, and that was a basis for the expert report. Here, what he's done is he's not asked them, but he's timed them. And we have testimony that is uncontroverted that says if you are a guard, you can arrive at whatever time you choose. So if a guard arrives 30 minutes before their shift starts, but it only takes them 5 minutes to get there, the expert is using that arrival time in the allotment of time that applies to each and every class member.
I'm sorry. Go ahead, Justice Bradley.
Thank you. But my understanding of the law is, and this is based on a review of Wright and Miller, you know, which is the Bible in this stuff, a representative sample may be permissible means of establishing class-wide liability, depending on the purpose for which the sample is being introduced. It goes on to say, proof from a sample based on an expert witness's estimation of the average time employees spend donning and doffing their gear could be used to show the common questions of law or fact predominated. Isn't that what the circuit court judge did here?
Well, here again, I'll just repeat, the Buofacao case, the Supreme Court also said that a court can deny class certification if the expert analysis, no reasonable juror could have believed that the employee spent roughly the same time engaging in the activity for which they seek compensation. That's clear in a donning and doffing case where putting on and taking off equipment is a specified contained activity. Here, walking from point A to point B based on arrival time of the guard's own choosing is not the same. The Buofacao court also said evidence cannot be used to calculate a fair or accurate estimate of the uncompensated hours an employee has worked. And it's the department's position that the evidence that the plaintiffs have gathered would not be a fair and accurate estimate of the uncompensated hours for each individual guard, each member of the putative class.
One question, if you could briefly answer that.
Yes.
If we're looking at manageability, isn't the trial court in the best position to make that determination? Because after all, It isn't the seven of us who have to manage the case. It's the trial court judge who will presumably preside over the matter and will create for himself or herself quite a headache if he or she certifies an unmanageable class or does so for his colleague as it's in Milwaukee County and the case may rotate. So if we're looking at the incentives here, isn't the trial court judge incented to make sure that indeed the class is manageable and again in a better position to make that determination, which is maybe in part why we have a discretionary standard of review here?
Well, my response to that would be yes, there is obviously a level of discretion, but the circuit court judge has to recognize what the law is, and the law in Wisconsin based on the In re Walmart litigation is that type of a class which allows for cross-examination, which is what happens here, is unmanageable, and that is a separate and distinct reason for denying the class than for the reason that the Court of Appeals held. And I thank you very much.
Thank you. The panel.
I had forgotten that a rebuttal with an active bench can be a much harder part of this because I have to weave
Welcome
in.
Welcome to the Supreme Court.
y'all look great. And so it's very fun but very challenging for an active advocate. So I want to second, I want to go to Justice Rebecca Bradley's manageability issue. And in connection with that, I want to emphasize the point you made, Chief Justice. But I want to start with this. The Department of Corrections are going to have plenty of time at trial, and they will. They will challenge this expert. They will cross-examine this expert. They will be able to raise all these issues about, you know, someone arriving, you know, just voluntarily to the prison instead of starting the work day. So, but to go to your manageability issue, I want to answer this way based on something that the Chief Justice mentioned. The Chief Justice mentioned Justice Easterbrook's decision, and I'm almost certain she was referring to Justice Easterbrook's decision in the Schleicher versus Wendt case, 618 F3rd 679. He deals with this merits issue, but Justice Bradley, what he also deals with is what he talks about as the mechanical aspects of a class, determining the individual damages and distributing those damages. Trial courts are just so suited, and particularly this judge, if you look at the hearing transcript and the order, they're well suited to do those mechanical aspects of distributing the damages between plaintiffs. If we're awarded damages, they will do everything they can within the rule of law to make sure that doesn't happen, and they're able advocates. They'll ably cross-examine. Dr. Rogers, he was not only in the Hodge case, he was also in the Hutzel case in Missouri, testimony used in both places. He was involved in that mechanical aspect of distributing between plaintiffs in the Hutzel case after trial. It is an important part of this because people had been damaged. They've been had to do different amounts of pre-shift, post-shift times. But it can really be calculated based on his overall report that looks at the averages, And then he would calculate their number of shifts and the wage rate. And we could come up with that mechanical answer for individual damages. That's how class actions.
And I agree with you, and I have every confidence a trial court judge can engage in that mechanical computation. But going to manageability, are you conceding that the state would have the right to introduce evidence on each of the roughly 5,000 employees and talk about the difference and explore the differences among their damage claims, or would the trial court step in and say, no, you can speed this up and group people together? But my question really is, if the state wants to introduce that evidence and go on an individual by individual basis, do they have that right?
No. Justice Bradley, and I think the trial judge will tire of that very quickly.
So would the jurors.
That's true. They'll certainly have the right to cross-examine the expert about the representative evidence, and, you know, I'm sure that will be a vigorous cross-examination. But this isn't the Walmart case. This is just like in the Coffeo. I just can't get this right all the time. But just like in Bucafio, it's, you know, representative evidence, very similar to that case. It's objective. They'll have the right to challenge it on cross-examination. And maybe they bring on a few witnesses if they're allowed collateral attacks on the evidence. But no trial judge is going to allow that. And can I... I'm sorry, my time's expired.
You finish your sentence.
So, the Walmart litigation, the problem with that case, of course, it wasn't objective evidence. The employees had filled it in themselves. They were the testifiers. And, of course, with respect to testifiers, you have a right to cross-examine. So very different situation here. It was so delightful to appear in front of you all. I know Wisconsin's honored by the just the extraordinary activity of this. I'm proud to be a Wisconsinite today.
Thank you. Very interesting oral argument this morning, and we had a lot of young learners here to take it all in. The court is adjourned in this case. We will reconvene for our second oral argument when the courtroom's prepared.